Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. From the Smithsonian, a delightful article that does include pictures of backpack-wearing dogs that have a very important job to do.
Ooh.
This is part of a pilot project that's underway at a 25-acre park in Lewes, a small town in East Sussex. And the park gets a lot of foot traffic from both humans and dogs, and that has caused some areas to become degraded.
Mm.
So some of the park managers were researching possible solutions, and that's how they came across this innovative rewilding project in Chile, where after wildfires had torched the landscape in 2017, they put three border collies wearing backpacks filled with seeds to restore that particular patch of land. So our English friends were like, could this work for us? So they got 10 pet dogs, outfitted them with special backpacks filled with the seeds of 23 plants, including foxgloves, common spotted orchids, and early purple orchids. They even mixed in some sand to help track where the dogs walked and cut back some of the trees in the area so that the ground would get more sunlight and not get choked out.
Hmm.
They were interested in other rewilding processes, but a lot of the larger scale ones often involve reintroducing large herbivores like bison or wild horses. And in smaller urban nature reserves, it's logistically a bit more difficult. So to replicate the effect that those animals have on the ecosystem, this is Dylan Walker, who led the project. We aimed to utilize the vast number of dog walkers that are hitting the nature reserve daily.
I mean, I guess none of these dogs are on leashes, because if the dog isn't running free, you could just give the seeds to the person, right? Like, there has to be the dog is
yep.
going out into an area where the people aren't.
Yeah, none of the dogs in the pictures are wearing leashes, but they may have excellent recall. Perhaps that's why they selected the 10 pets. Like, who here
right.
has the best recall?
Who's well-behaved and will come back?
Mm-hmm. Who can right. we trust with a holy backpack?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the project seems to be working, even though it's early. Some plants have sprouted. A lot of them are perennials, and so they're not going to really kick in until next spring. But in the meantime, the project is helping to engage and teach people about the ecological impacts of wildlife.
Yeah, and adorable dog backpacks. I mean, that you don't, the seeds are nice, but also just an excuse to put a backpack on a dog is cute.
Any excuse. Maybe they can like attach a little rodeo guy on top. I don't know. It's got a lot of potential. Next link.
Well, I am also on some domestic house pet related science over here. So
Woo-hoo!
This article comes to us from newatlas.com. It's titled Cat Poop Brain Parasite Could Be Hijacked to Deliver Drugs.
Whoa, wait,
okay.
That was a lot.
Yeah. There's a lot going on there. So kind of the opposite direction from what I'm imagining the regality of these little dogs carrying around backpacks. But it's our favorite friend, Toxoplasma gondii.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the intriguing and insidious parasite whose primary host is felines and can only sexually reproduce in the intestines of cats, but it can take a roundabout way to get there. It can infect many types of warm-blooded animals, including humans. Once ingested through infected meat, soil, or feces, it spreads throughout the body, including the brain. And once it's there, it's been known to release proteins that seem to affect the behavior of its intermediate host. Infected mice, for instance, become bolder and less anxious about cats, meaning that they're more likely to be eaten by them, delivering the parasite right back to its favored breeding ground. It even seems to make rodents more attractive to the opposite sex, increasing its chances of spreading the infection.
Hmm.
But these kind of spooky effects aside, T. gondii has naturally overcome a major hurdle that prevents scientists treating a host of neurological conditions, which is the blood-brain barrier. That defense mechanism keeps almost all molecules circulating in the bloodstream out of the brain, protecting that most vital of organs from harm. But unfortunately, therapeutic molecules are also blocked from entering, which makes it tricky to treat brain cancers and other diseases. So for this new study, an international team of researchers investigated whether the parasite's ability to cross the blood-brain barrier could be harnessed to deliver drugs. The team engineered T. gondii to pronounce a protein called MECP2, or MECP2, which is a promising candidate for treating a rare genetic neurological condition called Rett syndrome. Once that was done, the researchers tested whether the parasites could deliver MECP2 to the right cells in the brain. Sure enough, experiments in mice and in lab-grown mini-brains, I did not know that they were doing that, but apparently they
organelles! Yeah. We've covered them!
Yeah. And that showed that the T. gondii was able to smuggle the goods past the blood-brain barrier. So, it's an interesting idea, could eventually open a new way to treat neurological disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and it might be simpler than some other methods of bypassing the blood-brain barrier like magnetic nanoparticles, ultrasound, cell bots, or apparently bee venom. Those are all linked in this article if you're interested in finding out more about those methods. So the next step will be engineering the parasite to die off after it makes its delivery, because T. gondii can still do harm to brain cells. So
that's right. Let's partner up. Let's have a relationship with this and make sure that it has a kill switch.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Because I had the same questions. Like, I assume that the molecule would be exhausted by that point, but you've still got the T. gondii and, you know, that's not great. And I recently learned that apparently, like, many other countries except for the U.S., screen for it during pregnancy, and it is a risk, but we don't.
What's a risk, though? I mean, it's another profit line. Why would we characterize it a risk? That's expensive.
And it is pretty rare in the U.S. I mean, they're kind of like, why would we screen everybody if we're going to catch maybe one or two cases? But they do tell you if you're pregnant, they're like, do not change your cat's litter box. Don't mess with cat feces because you could pick this up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Won't delivering a medicine through T. gondii risk, like, synthesizing that molecule somehow? Like, how do we know it's going to remain inert through that delivery mechanism?
Yeah.
Sorry, that's really specific. There's no way you can.
That's a little bit beyond my scientific expertise, but I think that's
scientists,
a valid concern.
Just drum me an email.
it does sound like a concern, though. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, I was imagining that it seems like there's so many ways that could go wrong.
Right, because it could evolve to not die.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Or now we've got dead carcasses in our brain.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want a bunch of dead
you think
parasites.
We don't already. That's cute.
Extra ones in there.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, we'll see how you guys feel about this one. This one comes from Phys.org. New study finds people alter their appearance to suit their names.
I believe that, yeah.
Yep, a new study has found that people tend to alter their appearance to suit their names. So the research sought to determine whether parents choose a baby's name based on what seems fitting for the baby's appearance, or if individuals' faces' appearance change over the years to align with the stereotypes associated with their names. And they found out it's the latter.
Wow.
Yep, the study was published in the journal Proceedings of Natural Academy of Sciences. The research team was led by Dr. Crapface McGillicuddy. I don't think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Just kidding. In the study, 9 to 10-year-old children and adults were asked to match faces to names. The findings revealed that both the children and the adults correctly match adults' faces to their corresponding names significantly above chance level, which is crazy. But when it came to children's faces and names, the participants were unable to make accurate associations. But they didn't stop there. They, of course, got AI involved. So in another part of the study, a machine learning system was fed a large database of images of human faces. The computer recognized that the appearance of faces of adults with the same name were significantly more similar to others with faces of adults with different names.
Wow. I mean, and I'm assuming surely they took out, like, the ethnicity of a name, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if your name is Chen, you're not going to look like a white European, most likely, but fingers crossed they accounted for that, right?
That they didn't make it that obvious? Yes.
Yeah.
Does this imply there's some kind of, like, standardization for a name that expresses individual face? Kind of like we have those AI producing, like, the typical French woman or whatever.
Right. So they ask, well, why is this happening? And it seems it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it seems that facial appearance changes over long periods of time to align with the social stereotypes associated with the name.
Wow.
So as we all know, these stereotypes can be formed in many ways, right? A name can be linked to a famous figure or due to connections of a biblical name. One of the authors, actually, his name was Moses. So I'm sure he had a particular interest in this. Dr. Yanat Zwebner of Richmond University says, quote, "Our research highlights the broader significance of this surprising effect, the profound impact of social expectations. We've demonstrated that social constructs or structuring do exist, something that until now has been almost impossible to test empirically." So please, parents, be cautious of what you name your children out there.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense if you think about it. Like, your brain is the thing that controls, to a certain degree, your growth and how your face develops over time. So if your brain has an idea on a conscious level of what a Jennifer is supposed to look like, but also, that's insane.
Like, right. It's not just the brain, it's full cellular reaction.
And it's somewhat out of your control too, right? Because you could name your child something seemingly innocent, and then along comes Adolf and ruins a perfectly good
life. Right, exactly.
All of a sudden, your face can't grow anything but that mustache.
Oh, no.
Like, that's it. Of course, we're just at the beginning of this research, but it is interesting. Do I look like a Brad? And the reality is, sometimes I think, yep, I do look like that douchebag in movies in the 1980s.
It's because you grew up as a Brad in the 80s, where a Brad archetype had a very specific look and feel. But does this also kind of give credence to the power of people who legally change their name?
Yeah, I mean, if you're getting nicknames involved, like, does a Jenny look different than a Jennifer? I would argue yes.
So. Yes, absolutely. I can imagine a Jenny and a Jennifer right now, and they are different.
Yeah. One of them is not me. Let's be clear.
Well, one of them, Jenny is Asian, I think, because I've read Jenny Yang.
I've
had, like, Jenny, you know, Asian friends growing up. And so it's just, you know, what is your data set that is going to create this archetype of a name?
Mm-hmm.
Nominative determinism wins every time. Yeah. I mean, not every time, but way too frequently. It's weird. Yeah.
Yes, that, oh, you are what you think you are, or you are what they say you are, or you are what you eat. I'm confused. I'm
sorry.
All right, next link.
Next link.
All right, this next one is from a French-English podcast/website called Le Temps d'une Bière, or Time for a Beer. And the article is called American Beer Barons, How Busch, Pabst, and Schlitz Built Beer Empires.
Hmm.
So before we get to the major players, we've got a little background on how and why beer became popular in America in the first place. Because believe it or not, it wasn't always that way. At the beginning of the 19th century, in fact, Americans hardly drank any beer at all. They had plenty of good land for growing hops and grains if they'd wanted to, but it just wasn't popular for two main reasons. First, the nature of the trade routes at the time meant that America was flooded with cheap rum from the Caribbean. And second, the American colonies were overflowing with apple trees, which was used to make alcoholic cider and an even stronger drink called Applejack, which was so heavily fermented it had been known to simply kill people who drank it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I'd like to point out, third, it tastes like crap. I'm sorry. I'm not a
beer. No, I'm on board with you. I agree. Yeah.
Sorry.
There was also maybe a sense of proper beer needs to be made the proper way, which is to say with large and fairly complex brewing equipment. And they had that in Europe, but most of the immigrants to America in those early days were not especially wealthy. So even if they had the expertise and the desire to make beer, they couldn't afford to import and maintain the equipment. But all of that changed with the Napoleonic Wars in Europe. Because for one thing, the conflict temporarily cut off trade with the Caribbean, so we lost that source of not only rum, but the sugar needed to make rum. And secondly, these wars involved a lot of wealthy dukes and barons who started looking pretty keenly at America as a place where they could escape the guillotine. And over the course of just a couple of decades, more than 3 million Germans immigrated to the New World, bringing both their money and their cultural expectations, including beer. And among them was a young man named Adolphus Busch, who was the son of wealthy wine merchants back in Germany, and was also, side note, the 21st of 22 children. I know, If I had 22 kids, I'd become a wine merchant, too.
And also before we killed the Adolf name.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. He was still okay back then. But because his parents were in the wine business, he had some knowledge of brewing, and he quickly set up a business importing and selling brewing equipment in America. And one of his customers was a man named Eberhard Anheuser, who was actually a soap manufacturer who had ended up owning a brewery kind of by accident. Basically, one of his customers had gone bankrupt and had given him the brewery in order to pay off his debts.
Don't you hate when that happens?
I know. Anheuser's like, I'm a soap guy. I don't know what to do with this. But he's trying to make this thing work. He doesn't really know what he's doing. And meanwhile, Busch is noticing that Anheuser's daughter is pretty cute. So the two of them get married and Busch takes over his father-in-law's brewery. And he did a great job. He tripled production. The family's doing really well. And then the Civil War hits, which was economically bad for a lot of businesses, but it was a huge boost for beer because the Union High Command decided that rum and whiskey were forbidden among soldiers, but they allowed the low-alcohol beer of German brewers because of its, quote, non-intoxicating nature. So the bar was different back then.
Mm-hmm.
So the Anheuser Brewery is just rolling in money post-Civil War, but this is also when some of their major competitors start to rise to national prominence as well, including the so-called Captain Pabst, who had also married into an existing family of brewers and who saw a big surge in business after a fire in 1871 wiped out half the city of Chicago, along with most of his local competitors. This is also apparently when Joseph Schlitz comes on the scene, although the article barely mentions him, other than to say that he invented the brown glass bottle, which protected the beer from light and thus kept it fresh for longer. And he was also heavily invested in refrigerated rail cars that would allow his beer to travel further across the country.
And he liked to start fires, apparently.
Did he? Oh, yeah. So up to this point, these guys have largely been operating in their own markets, and it all comes to a head at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. So by now, the Anheuser-Busch Brewery is being run by Busch's son, August, and he loves flaunting his wealth to the point that his name had become slang in St. Louis for showing off, as in, look at that guy being all bushy.
I'm bringing that back.
Exactly. So August had multiple estates, a luxury train car for when he needed to travel, and the largest personal park in the United States at that time with hundreds of gardeners and exotic animals. So for the World's Fair, he's like, people need to know. And he spent $15,000, which would be something like $500,000 today, building a massive pavilion that contained a perfect miniature replica of his brewery. And, you know, he's super proud of this. He's like, I did a great job, until he sees the Pabst Pavilion. Because Captain Pabst had realized that this wasn't an advertisement. This was a war. He spent $20,000 on just his pavilion, which was adorned with Greco-Roman architecture and these little carved cherubs enjoying Pabst beer. And then spent another $100,000 on a miniature replica of his brewery, but plated in real gold and silver.
Oh, my God.
And the judges of the World's Fair were blown away and awarded first place in the beer category to Pabst, who quickly integrated the blue ribbon into their brand and continue to use it to this day. Yeah, that's where it comes from. It's the Chicago World's Fair. And Busch was furious. He demanded a recount. He was quoted in the papers saying that Pabst was an inferior beer made with cheap ingredients. But the main reason he lost his mind is that it turns out he had actually invested quite a lot of side money into buying off the judges. And he figured out that there was actually only one judge he had failed to successfully bribe, a chemistry expert from Germany who had been the deciding vote, and Busch spent the next 6 months trying to track the guy down overseas and force him to change his score. Unfortunately, he failed, and Pabst kept their claim to fame. But on the other hand, I do think it's fair to say that Anheuser-Busch won in the end. Like, I don't think anybody really considers Pabst to be a high-quality beer. But again, I don't think Budweiser is a high-quality beer either, because all beer is gross. I'm with you, Bradley. Anyway, the article goes on to discuss Prohibition and World War II and even the Cold War. So if you're interested in all that, you can check it out. But basically, this was the point where everybody was really big and they were just being mean to each other from there on out. And I can tell you they stopped short of the most important milestone in the Anheuser-Busch history, which is, of course, the infamous Was Up ad from 1999.
Oh.
Which you can still see online if you want to. I went and looked it up, so.
Wait, when was it again?
1999.
Oh.
Yeah.
The dawn of a new millennium, and we're punctuating it with beer ads.
That's okay. Yep. The Frog ad was 1995, so that was even worse. Like, if y'all remember that.
That was the beginning of the end. That's when the bad timeline officially diverged.
It was the frog ad. Fault. The frogs did it to us. Absolutely.
Alex Jones tried to warn us.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, from the BBC, there's a fascinating article on how the decline of the Indian vulture led to 500,000 human deaths.
Whoa.
Yeah, kind of a big deal. And to start the story, we have to kind of go back into history. Once upon a time, the vulture was an abundant and ubiquitous bird in India. These birds would hover over sprawling landfills. They would look for cattle carcasses. Sometimes they would freak pilots out by getting sucked into jet engines during airport takeoffs. It was, you know, they were that plentiful. But more than two decades ago, the vultures began dying because of a drug used to treat sick cows. Huh. And then by the mid-1990s, the 50 million strong vulture population had plummeted to near zero, all because of diclofenac, a cheap non-steroidal painkiller for cattle that is fatal to vultures. Now, the drug has been banned since 2006, and so the decline has slowed in some areas, but at least three species have suffered long-term losses of 91 to 98%.
Wow.
And that's not all, according to a new study. Unintentional decimation of these heavy scavenging birds allowed deadly bacteria and infections to proliferate, leading to the deaths of about 500,000 people over a period of 5 years. So they compared human death rates in Indian districts that once thrived with vultures to those with historically low vulture populations. What they found was that after anti-inflammatory drug sales had risen and vulture populations collapsed, human death rates increased by more than 4%. And they also found the effect was greatest in urban areas with large livestock populations where carcass dumps were common. And, you know, they say it's not cute and cuddly. They've got pictures of this vulture. It is a gothic marvel.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, they make the neighborhood not smell bad anymore. You want to appreciate the birds. And I mean, they don't even attack humans at all. They only eat dead material, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. They're there to eat the carrion and have evolved to synthesize basically all the nasties that would otherwise spread if not alchemized within their own body. So now the remaining vulture populations in India, they're concentrated around protected areas where their diet consists of dead wildlife.
Right. We weren't drugging that.
Correct. Yeah. We're not doing livestock. It's just they're being real vague, but wildlife, right? But to save them, because these continuing declines suggest ongoing threats for vultures, which is a concern because their declines have negatively affected our well-being. So we do have some promising signs. Last year, 20 vultures that had been bred in captivity and fitted with satellite tags and rescued, they were released from a tiger reserve in West Bengal, and more than 300 vultures were reported in the recent survey.
So they're breeding. They're coming back. We just have to, like, make sure if a cow has a headache, no medicine for it. It doesn't get any pain meds. Like, too bad.
Yeah. Livestock management, and also just, you know, do we have a practice where we can make sure that they're getting what they need? I don't know. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out, right?
I mean, India will. It's not really
India
our choice.
India will figure it out. We'll help. Okay. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from popularmechanics.com. It's titled, 63 Ancient Tombs Have Emerged in Egypt with Long-Lost Treasures and Statues Inside.
Ooh. Huh. Nuh-uh.
That's
I would
lot.
Have thought surely we were done with that by now. Like, we found them all, but no.
Not looted?
Not.
Yeah, no. I mean, these are brand new ones. It's on the northern coast of Egypt from roughly 2,600 years ago. Pretty wild.
Wow. Oh, now is the time to open an unopened Egyptian tomb. Totally.
I know, right?
Yeah, we need some more curses.
Yeah, 63 new curses for the world. Great. Thanks, y'all.
An old ancient disease that we let out of there.
Right. 63 new microbes.
So archaeologists uncovered more than just brick tombs during that recent discovery on the northern coast of Egypt. The team found ancient treasure in the form of bronze coins and gold foil statues. Wow. And according to a translated statement from Egypt's Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities, the town of Damietta was once a thriving hub of trade. Now, in modern times, it's continuing to unveil that past through its archaeology, the latest wave coming from all brick tombs from both the late period and the more recent Ptolemaic period that stretched from 323 BC to 30 BC. Mohamed Ismail Khaled, Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Archaeology, said in a translated statement that the tombs are reminiscent of others found in the late period, emphasizing the historical significance of the discovery, which can help fill out the knowledge of Damietta and Egypt's 26th family dynasty during that time. Within the various tombs, researchers found funeral pyres, pottery, and figurines meant to resemble idols that the Egyptians believed would serve the deceased in the afterlife for eternity. It was within both the figurines, known as ushabati, and the pottery that the crews found the good stuff. Many of the ushabati statues were covered in gold foil, while a vase from a more recent tomb featured 38 bronze coins. The gold foil highlighted the importance of the Egyptian religious idols, symbolic pieces that often accompanied the wealthy in their tombs. Simon Ashmawi, head of the Egyptian archaeological sector, said in a statement that the mix of both local and imported pottery puts a spotlight on the trade exchange between Damietta and the cities of the Mediterranean coast. Unfortunately, no real pictures yet, just statements, so we can't really see the goods quite yet, but I thought it was really cool that we're still discovering this.
Right. Well, you know, you can't give away the GPS coordinates of your dig site, then everybody just comes and takes everything.
I want it to be like a rare tomb for like a jester, and it's all just like Egyptian clown stuff, and they haven't really figured out how to like communicate this.
Right. There's something very embarrassing in that tomb, and they're trying to find the right way to say it.
Or, you know, in the afterlife, if it's actually true, that person had all their stuff, and then one day, none of their stuff they have anymore in the afterlife. Like, where did it all go?
That's right. We've taken it now. Now they're like, oh.
No, I got nothing.
They're
going to
come looking for it. Get ready.
That's right.
Next link.
Next link.
Well, speaking of antiquities, this comes from Smithsonian Magazine. Nashville Museum returns hundreds of pre-Columbian artifacts to Mexico. For many years, Nashville's Parthenon Museum housed hundreds of pre-Columbian artifacts in its collection. Many of the items were accompanied by incomplete information about what they were and where they came from. Bonnie Seymour noticed these objects about 2 years ago when she started working as the Parthenon's assistant curator. During her first day at the job, as she toured the collection, she was unsettled by their presence, and she said to herself, well, these are going to go. So this month, the valuable artifacts are going home. The Nashville Museum is returning 248 ceramics, musical instruments, tools, and clay sculptures of animals to Mexico City, where they will be housed in the National Institute of Anthropology and History. Before they were returned, the artifacts went on display at the Parthenon one last time at an exhibition called Repatriation and Its Impact. The show explored the history of repatriation and placed the pre-Columbian pieces alongside work by Jose Gonzalez, a Mexican artist based in Nashville. Recently, Seymour got a call from Rich Montgomery, who had heard about the exhibition on NPR. He explained that he and his brother had collected many of the artifacts on the instructions of his father, John Montgomery, a doctor based in Oregon. John had been looking for a way to lower his income taxes and decided to use museum donations to get tax deductions.
It's a strategy. It works.
Yeah, Rich Montgomery and his brother went to Western Mexico and purchased the artifacts from local farmers who apparently were happy to part with them for a few pesos, he says. Mm. Quote, at no point did we think or feel we were doing anything illegal. His father and his friend Edgar York donated their acquisitions to the Parthenon throughout the 60s and 70s. And unfortunately, because pre-Columbian artifacts have been particularly popular for people to take, a lot of Mexican history is still missing. So there's a lot of gaps, and Seymour hopes that she can fix the problem. So, okay, that's all good news. But I do have a slight alternative take.
Mm-hmm.
When we visited England, we went to the museum with two of our English friends and looking around at some of the artifacts that were coming from the Middle East. And one of them made a very British comment that said, you know, well, we can't trust them with it.
Oh, wow.
Because there's some factual evidence on that, too. We have to remember in 2015, ISIS attacked Mosul and destroyed everything in the museum, blew up statues of Buddha. Some of the pieces were rescued and brought to Europe. So this begs the question, when do we give it back? Do we leave it there? Do we let them destroy it?
Who gets to decide?
Who gets to decide that? So that's the gray area that these museums
have. But at least we're moving past, it didn't feel like we were doing anything illegal at the time, because that's not really a good benchmark.
Correct. I mean, with this, with the Montgomerys, I kind of feel like it's not like they were colonizers who slaughtered everybody and took the pots they were using hundreds of years ago. These right. are modern guys who went down there and were like, hey, farmer, I'll pay you for the stuff that's in your dirt.
Yeah.
And the farmer's like,
souvenirs?
Okay. You know, so on the one hand, it's like, yeah, it should be given the respect it deserves as an artifact. But also, mm-hmm. these guys collected something that otherwise was probably going to get destroyed by a tiller or otherwise thrown in the garbage. So there is something to be said for, like, you know, they weren't trying to steal it. They were just collecting it from a place where it was sitting untouched.
We're not really certain what the indigenous population assigned value to it, though. We're assuming they thought it was worthless, but they also could have been in extreme monetary desperation.
Right.
That'll make
be.
You do some
yeah.
stuff, right?
That's true.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a mogul comes by and makes you an offer you can't refuse. That's pennies to him, but possibly very significant for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Where it would be
no,
too
absolutely.
Difficult to go through the protocol, right, to actually get it put into
the bribe channels. Those are expensive.
So I get it. It's the gray area of some mm-hmm. of these museums, but again, I'm glad we're making the effort, we're having the conversation,
yeah.
and a lot of the stuff is going back to places, to their own museums, which is
yeah
great. But also, you know, the selfish side of me says, I don't want to have to go all the way to Mexico to see some of that stuff.
Right. I need it closer to here.
Yeah, right. You're going to just be in Austin?
It's time for more traveling tours is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Collections to go around.
Right.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include why the Olympics almost banned this shoe, what made this huge hole under Greenland, and why are people always pointing the finger at furries? So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.